So there are a lot of errors in the lecture notes, which I am trying to correct before the lecture. Like when I prepare for the lecture today, I found so many errors in the note for today's lecture, which you might already have now. But yeah, I'll make sure that they are correct before your interview, so you have the correct notes with you while you're preparing for your interviews. The tutorials have been uploaded. They're not the final version. The final version would be on the day of your tutorial. So there might be some changes if I notice some errors, but you get the idea what main questions would be on the tutorials. The feedback, I'm happy. Most of you either had good feedback, like, and some didn't have any suggestions for further improvement, which means I hope they're okay with how things are now progressing. And there were a few suggestions regarding inconsistencies in the notations, so I'll work on them. So for today's lecture, I won't be using the slides, just to avoid confusion in inconsistencies. And from Wednesday onwards, if I use slides, I'll make sure that the notations on my board and on the slides are same, okay? It's just the part of the lecture which I'm going to play on slides is the one which we couldn't cover last lecture, okay? The Fermi Golden Rule. Someone wants the slides to be shared, it leads the equation. So if you want just to see the equations, Pirsa, the lectures are being recorded and they are being put on Pirsa. All the links are on the SAI portal. I'm putting all the links lecture-wise on the course website. So they have those screenshots and you can note down the equations from there if you want, okay? So there was one common question for all, which was, and there was also some good suggestion that I should probably be also writing the physical intuition, a part of it at least on the board, so that it helps, it gives you time to grasp what I'm trying to give, like you get time to build a physical intuition of it, okay? So I'll try to write more on the board without wasting much time. The common question which a lot of you had was related to Fermi Golden Rule and why probability of transition should be proportional to time and why rate should not depend on time. That was the question. We are going to cover this Fermi Golden Rule today and then start with density matrix formulation. So what does rate define? Rate of decay or rate of transition is like something, what's the probability of the decay or transition at any instant of time, right? So you have, if you have a radioactive nuclei and you're observing it and there's a probability that it'll decay, the decay rate or the decay probability should not depend at what time you're observing, right? It should depend on the interval of the time. So at 1 second, if I'm observing, I'm trying to see if it decayed or not, that decay probability should be exactly equal to like after 10 seconds if I observe it. So the decay rate is the probability that it decays at any instant of time, and it should not depend on what time you're trying to observe it. It's just the definition of decay rate, but why it doesn't change with time is the observation. We have seen it, like there are experiments who have tried to see if the decay rates or decay constants, which are these rate transitions, W, which we are talking about, if they change over a period of time. They have been, so this question has been in researchers' mind that if they are constant or they change with time, okay? And they found some variations. Obviously, there should be some variations depending on the environment and temperature, pressure, and so on, but the change in these rate transitions which they found was very small, and it could easily be a part of the noise, you can say. So these decay rates are constant because lifetimes are same for the, so these decay constants are, they give you the lifetime for the decays. If you take inverse of these rates, it gives you the lifetime of the atom or of the radioactive nuclei. And every radioactive nuclei or an atom, they have a signature lifetime. It doesn't depend on time, right? Does that satisfy you all? Okay. It's just by observation. So experimentally, it has been observed that these transition rates are constant over a period of time. Okay. So we had what we noticed, we had done these probability of transitions. We calculated them and we came up with a form like this. And we saw that it depended on three quantities, Vf and temperature, this time, and also the energy differences. And then we were trying to see how each of these parameters it changes this probability of transition. And we kind of had seen, like, if we had non-energy conserving transitions, which means that omega Fi is not equal to zero, they have a sine square nature, so they're very like this over a period of time, but this probability of transition is really, really small, which should be because these are energy non-conserving transitions. So probability of them happening should be very small. For this particular case, we made some approximation for this form here, which is like 0 by 0 form. And we said that the probability of transition is proportional to T squared, which we said shouldn't be, because this would mean that the rate of transition, which is probability at any instant of time, would be proportional to T, which should not be. It should be a constant. So which tells us that this probability of transition should not be a quadratic dependence, should not have quadratic dependence on time, but a linear dependence on time. Okay, and what went missing in our picture when we were trying to calculate these probability of transition was that we were taking the transitions from one state I to state F, and we are considering that these states are really sharp. Okay, so there was no width for this level where they were exciting to. So if we assume that, yes.
Is this like probability not supposed to be less than one?
What shouldn't be?
I mean the transitional probability.
For which case?
For this case, for example.
It should be really, really less than one.
Because I was.
This is not to scale. It's just to give you how it behaves. It's not to scale. So the constants which appear in front, it's a good observation, but it's not. I should have mentioned it. So these pictures are not to scale. They're just giving you the behavior with respect to time. That's all. Okay. So if instead of taking a sharp level F, I say that it has a finite width, okay, then the probability of transition from I to F should include the probabilities to this width, right? So my probability should not be just PIF, but it should be probability of transition to all the possible F levels in here, okay? And I can write this as an integral where this rho is the number density, and it's defined as the number of states per unit energy around EF. Okay. So how dense this level is, and the density would give me how many number of levels are in this width. And when I'm calculating the total probability, I should obviously add up over all the probabilities. Okay. So if I try to find my probability of transition, using this, I'll just substitute pi from here for one level. Okay. Now, if you look at this integrand here, this integrand has maximum contribution from the energy values where omega fi is equal to 0, right? This is where this integrand is going to be maximum. And in fact, 95% of the contribution to this probability comes from the energy levels where EF is equal to EI. So I can safely say that over this small EF interval, my rho EF is a constant, okay? So I can assume that, and it's a constant. So it doesn't vary much over this width of the final state which I'm considering, okay? And I can take this out of the integration, assuming that it doesn't depend on EF. And same is for the VFI. So if I do that, this is the maximum contribution. So assuming that VFI and rho EF, they don't change much over this EF width, which I'm considering, my integration simplifies
I just missed it. We're saying that is EF like between two bands or within the same width of a band that has a width?
So this is a band.
Yeah.
Let's say it has some width delta EF.
Okay.
Okay. And EF is the, DF is the say variable within this band. Okay. And we are trying to see the variation. Okay. All right. So now, just look at the integrand in between. This is the integrand. Let's see how it behaves. So the integrand is a sine square and if I just multiply divided by 4, this behavior is like a diffraction pattern, right? And if I try to plot this, what I'll see is that it behaves like a diffraction pattern. The central lobe is the one which is contributing the most, which we said should be. And the central lobe is the one where my EF is equal to EI. So this is the energy axis, omega FI. And this is the probability of transition. And the maximum contribution for this integrand should be where x is equal to 0, which means omega fi is equal to 0. Okay, and it'll have some minimas as well. For example, the maxima is at omega fi is equal to 0, the peak maxima. And then it has few minimas, and minimas would be at when sine square is 0, which will be at 2 pi by t, 4 pi by t, 6 pi by t, and so on. So these are the minimas of my integrand. If you look at the width of this peak, the width is proportional to 1 over t, right? The width is proportional to 1 over time. And if I just ignore these side lobes, because they're really small, the central lobe should have an area 1, because the probability should be equal to 1. That means the height of this peak should be proportional to? So if the width is proportional to 1 over t, the height should be proportional to time, which means as time increases, my probability that energy conserving transition is taking place, it keeps on increasing. And all these lobes, which means the energy non-conserving transitions, because here the energies are not conserved, the probability is going to keep on decreasing. Let me show you. So this is the time axis. Again, it's not to scale. And if I keep on increasing time, you see the central lobe, the side lobes, they keep on kind of merging in the center, and the width of the central lobe is decreasing, and the height is increasing. So as time increases, the probability that the transition where EF is equal to EI is going to keep on increasing, okay? And the probability that all other transitions is going to keep on decreasing. Does that make sense? Okay. Just this part of the board. And this integrand, if I take this integration over d omega fi by changing df to e d omega fi, they're interchangeable. This is equal to pi by 2 h cross t. Okay, so this is a standard integration. You'll find it, and if you want, I can provide the steps as well. If I now substitute this integral part for my probability, what I'll see is that my probability of transition to that finite width would be which is proportional to time, which means the rate of transition is a constant. And this is Fermi's golden rule. Yes?
What are the bounds on the integral?
You can take it from minus infinity to infinity. It won't matter because ideally the bound should be between the width of the energy level EF. So I'll say this is minus del EF by 2 and del EF by 2. It's within this width of the level which you are considering, the final level. Okay, now question. We said that for this constant, yes.
For the integration, are we now integrating over the omega not?
They are just interchangeable, omega and f, so you can make that change of.
Should you multiply by
h cross, yes. All right, so for a constant perturbation, so this was the exercise for a constant perturbation, and constant perturbation, as expected, should give us transitions where energy is not changing. That's what's happening. The probability for energy conserving transition is maximum. Can you think of example where I have transition between two levels, now it has a width, I and f. They are different levels, they are different energy states, but their energies are same. So this is one of the questions in your tutorial, which we'll discuss tomorrow, okay? And before that, if you can come up with more examples of this. If somebody has an idea which...
Can you repeat the question?
The question is, usually what happens for an atomic system, I have, let's say, two energy levels. for cesium, the ground state is 6s. The first excited state is 6p½ or 6p³½. Now, if I want this transition to happen, I have to give this much amount of energy or frequency, right? In this case, it's a constant perturbation. I'm not giving any frequency which could make that transition happen. So, as expected, what's happening is transition is happening, but transition is happening from a level EI to a level EF, where the energies for these levels is same. Okay, so maybe I should not put them like one above, but maybe side to side. So they have same energies and the transition is happening. Can you think of an example, an atomic system maybe or some other system where this could happen? So they are degenerate, but the levels are not same. They're different.
What do you mean by level? You mean like physically they represent like two different configurations or something?
Yes, this is what I exactly mean. They represent a different configuration. The spins? And within spins, you're talking about what kind of transition? I'm talking about electronic transitions here. So I don't know what should transit between spins. Only the spins should flip, yes, if I apply a magnetic field. But I won't count that as a transition happening.
Yeah. Maybe I would take the hydrogen atom and like fix M. You know, and you have something like 2s going to 2p, but there will be like a change in angular momentum, so it's kind of weird.
But that, again, angular moment, okay. But S and P have different energies, right? 2s and 2p, they have different energies.
Say, if you have like excited states in, say, 2p.
Okay.
The 2px and 2py transition between them.
Okay. So you say for the hydrogen atom, transition happening from 2px to 2py and 2pz because they have same energy, something like that? Is that what you mean? What kind of transitions? That's interesting. Maybe there's something in literature regarding that. Let me think about this. Would I be calling that transition or not? Because they're all equally probable. Like if I have a system where three electrons are present, the electrons, how they are going to align themselves in px, py, pz would depend on the Hund's rule, right? I think they still won't be energy conserving transition. I can think about it more because let's say I have two in px and one transits to py, the energy should not be conserved here because that's a stable configuration where they are paired, anti like aligned. So I don't think it still should be energy conserving transition. But I can think about it more, yeah.
In 3D blocks.
Okay.
There are many degenerate states.
Yes, that could be one, yes. Between degenerate states, makes sense. For a three-dimensional harmonic oscillator or three-dimensional particle box. Okay, let's talk about this more. But there are some good suggestions if you have more.
Maybe if I have like the Fermi surface, then I can have like transitions on the Fermi surface or something like that.
Okay, and maybe it's related because there are some transitions on the Fermi surface. I don't know what they are called. I don't know if they are related to this or not. But yeah, there are so many suggestions coming and that's really wonderful. So I'll talk about an atomic system here where this could happen in tutorial tomorrow, okay? All right, so.
Well, EFs here are continuous states, right?
Sorry?
EFs here like constitute to continuous states, right?
EF? No, it's not necessary, but yeah, they could be. That's one you're thinking like an atomic physicist.
But technically, that's what you did, right? When you fixed the raw EF.
No, I just fixed the width. That's what we talk about. Each level, atomic level, has a fixed width. They are stationary in math. But they are not sharp. They have a finite lifetime. So this width here means that they have a finite lifetime. It's not a continuum state. It could be, but in this case, it's not. It's not necessary that they are a continuum state. Okay. Yeah.
You mean that they're discrete energy bands?
It's a band of energy, yes.
And
I wouldn't call it discrete, but it's a band of energy which is continuous.
Okay, and are we fixing the number density of each band?
Would be different depending on which energy level you're looking at. So EF will have a different band as compared to EF prime.
I was wondering on the top part where when we integrated, why we were able to take the rho out of the integral.
Huh. Okay, so this rho, it depends, it should depend on the EF. So EF is the small, DEF is the small integration variable here. Ideally, it should not, but the variation is really, really small, and that's not the main reason. The main reason is that this rho has maximum contribution from, not rho, I would say, this entire integrand has maximum contribution from the energy where energy EI is equal to EF. That's what we saw here. Maximum contribution comes from the central peak. So I can safely say that rho EF is a constant. Okay? Is that okay? Okay. Okay. Can we move to the next topic? Yeah.
I'm just curious. What would happen if I take like a harmonic perturbation of like frequency omega? Would that be like, would then the maximum be like separated by like h bar omega or something?
Yes, exactly. This is what happens with the atomic transitions. So if I have omega, like harmonic, and this is the energy difference, the transition would happen where they are same. This is the tutorial problem in, I think, third tutorial. This is exactly what we are going to see. And this is related to something called Rabi oscillations, like transition between I and F, and then F to I and F, and it's an oscillatory process. Okay, so the harmonic case we are going to do as a part of tutorial. Okay. So I won't be using slides today because there might be some inconsistencies in the notations, and I don't want to confuse you all. So here's the outline of my talk or my lecture. Can I use this part? Because I'm not going to use it much and I want to keep it on the board. Yeah. So we'll first talk about single, not much we know, but we are going to talk about something called composite systems and how we represent them in quantum mechanics. Okay, bracket notations. Then we are going to talk about what is the problem with the bracket, like the quantum mechanics which we have been doing till now for the Schrodinger, Heisenberg, and interaction picture. I won't say problem, but yeah, there are some issues which problem this quantum mechanics which you have been using, it can't address. So we need a different theory for it. And we'll define something called density matrices, or they're also called density operators. We'll define them. We'll try to see their properties. We'll see how they evolve in time, because we have been all together talking about evolution, right? Schrodinger, how time states evolve with time in Schrodinger, Heisenberg, interaction, and so on picture. So we'll talk about the time evolution. And then we'll do two examples. we'll see how the density matrix for a single spin looks like. For spin, not single, it could be like more than single, but I would call this a pure spin, and I'll describe what this pure word here means. And then also density matrix for a mixture of spin, and I'll define what a mixture of spin means. This is not the end, but I don't think we have more topics to be covered for density matrix, which I don't think I can cover today. But on Wednesday, we'll cover the part for the density matrix. The end question which we want to address is the decoherence using density matrices, because this formulation didn't give any idea about decoherences except for if we see interference pattern, that's all. Okay, so we'll see how using this formulation is going to address our problem of looking at decoherences and what they actually mean. Okay? All right, so quickly going through the single state, we know that in our usual quantum mechanics, we represent single states by a state vector. Operators are given by Hermitian matrices. Time evolution is given by the Schrodinger equation or Heisenberg equation of motion. And we also saw how measurements are given. Like, so whenever I try to measure or observe the system, my system, which if I can write as a linear combination of my bases, it's going to collapse into one of these states with this probability. Okay, so all this we know from our previous quantum mechanical courses. What I want to talk about is a composite system. And let's take a system of like two particles. Okay. For two particles, we still, in quantum mechanics, write their state as a wave function. We represented that this way. And in terms of the wave function of my two particles, it's given as an inner product. A tensor product. So this symbol here means a tensor product. How many of you are familiar with tensor products? OK. So should I give you one example for those who haven't seen them? So let's say throughout this lecture, we are going to talk about spins, all right? So let's say I have a single spin, and it's in up state, which I write as 0. And it's given as 1, 0. Okay? And the second spin is in a down state, which I write as 1, and give as 0, 1. Okay? So the tensor product here would mean, so the composite system of A and B, both spins, would be which would mean multiplying the entire basis with the each element. So 1 is multiplied by the entire 0, 1. And 0 is multiplied by 0, 1. So this is my composite state for a spin, where one spin is in up and other spin is in down. Does anyone have, because this is going to be used. And if this is not clear, things are not going to be clear in lecture ahead. So does anyone has a problem with this representation, just let me know. OK. And the operators for a composite system, and we are mostly going to talk about local operators, OK? So there's no non-locality. There's no entanglement or something. Non-locality means if I'm doing an experiment here with my system, some other system, it gets affected somewhere else. All right, that's a non-local operator. So local operator would mean that if I do some operation on I, it doesn't affect my B. And if I do some operation on B, it doesn't affect my system A. So they are independent operations. And for example, let's say for this particular case, I say write an operator where the operation is being done only on my system A, and it flips the spin 0 to spin 1 state. So in that case, you would say A is an operator which switches spin 0 to 1, okay? And the complete operation would be, so A acting on my psi A, but doing nothing to my psi B, okay? An identity, when it acts on psi A, psi B, so this operation acts only on this, and this operation only on B. These are local operations. Okay. And then time evolution for such systems. The Hamiltonian, in, again, non-local. So I have a Hamiltonian which is only affecting my system A and not B. My total Hamiltonian would mean something like this. Okay. So this part of the time evolution affects only psi A, and this part of the time evolution only affects psi B. Okay. And when I do measurement with such composite systems, since my composite system, it consists of two particles now, and each has its own basis. So let's again take example of spin, and let's say my spin now is in superposition of 0 and 1, and the second spin is also in a superposition of 0 and 1. Now when I do measurement on such systems, if I do joint measurement, which means I'm measuring A and B both, what I'll get is, I'll see psi A has collapsed either into 0 or 1. And similar for psi B. So the end result could be a 0-0 state for psi A and B, or 1-0, or 0-1, or 1-1. Okay? These are the four possibilities for joint measurement. And by joint measurement, I mean I'm measuring both. Because for such systems, so this is joint measurement, like complete measurement, I don't know what's the. There's something also called partial measurement. Which I can do with my composite system. And partial would mean I'm doing measurement only on one and not looking at the second. And as expected, what would happen is if I'm doing partial measurement on such a system, and such a system is called a product state, product system. These are not entangled, okay? We'll talk about entangled a little later. So if I do such partial measurements on product state, which means if I'm only making measurement on A, it'll collapse in 0 or 1, but B should remain in the superposition of 0 and 1, which makes sense. That would be partial measurement. So there's no problem so far with the quantum mechanical description of composite systems. Let's talk about a case where we are doing partial measurement on not such kind of systems, but systems which are entangled, okay? A very good example of entangled systems is a singlet state. And singlet state, it refers to a system where the electrons are paired such as their total spin is zero. So if one is in up state, the other has to be in down and vice versa, okay? And this singlet state need not be locally bounded, which by locally bounded, I mean there's something now called non-local operations coming into picture now. So with local operations, when we talk about local operations, there's no problem with quantum mechanics. There is one, which is like representing ensembles, which we'll talk about later. But if we are not talking about ensembles, then non-local operation has no problem with quantum mechanics. Local operations. But when we talk about non-local operations, like in the case of singlet states or entangled states, we come into a problem which quantum mechanics cannot address. But the density matrix formulation helps us address that, not understand, but address that. Okay.
How do you define a non-local operation?
Yeah. So singlet state, non-local operation would mean if I'm doing something with my system here, the other system is affecting. That's one example of a non-local operation, which happens with entangled states. Okay. So, and these singlet states, they are like in can be represented. Maybe I should also write something which is very useful.
Partial measurement is a local operation because you only affect psi A without affecting psi B.
It depends on what system you are measuring. So if I'm doing partial measurement on such product states, then yes. But if I'm doing partial measurement on states like singlet, then it's altogether a different story. Okay. Let me write the notations which I'm going to use throughout the lecture for spins. So I'll be using plus minus or a plus minus with a Z for my Z basis representation for spin. And for X basis and for Y basis, okay? And these are the eigenbases for my X, Y, and Z, if you remember, we talked on Bloch sphere, okay? So this is Z plus Z plus minus Z and so on, okay? And if I don't write a Z like a subscript, then explicitly it means I'm talking about the Z basis, okay? So singlet state, let's say in Z basis, would mean that first spin is in up and the second is in down, or it could be the other way. This is a singlet spin in Z basis, okay? And I could observe this singlet in X and Y basis as well, okay? Now, let's see what's the problem with such singlet states or entangled states when we try to do partial measurement on them. So let's say a part of, there are like 100 singlet states, and a part of the singlet state is with Alice, and part of the singlet state is with Bob, okay? So each has 100 pairs, 100 spins belonging to this singlet state. Okay, let me draw a box. So Alice has this box, and Bob has this box. They each have 100 spins. One of these spins represents one singlet from this pair, and one spin represents the other singlet from this pair, all right? Now, let's say Alice and Bob, they separate. This is what usually experiments talk about. And Alice decides to measure her spin. Now, when she's measuring her spin, she's doing measurement on a quantum system, right? it's a superposed system. What she gets is a result with quantum probability. So Alice's outcome would be something like this. There are actually two only. So maybe this part of the board is not required. So what will Alice get? Alice either get an up with half probability, or she'll get a down with half probability. You all agree, right? And these probabilities are the quantum probabilities because she is making measurement on a quantum system. Now, when she makes a measurement on her part of the spin, what happens to the Bob spins? So if she makes a measurement on one spin, she sees an up. That means that corresponding
is down.
Is in down, right? And so on for all. Now, Bob has a mixture of up and down, but is this mixture a quantum mixture? Like, is there some kind of superposition with these spins which Bob has? No. They're all classical. They are either up or down, right? So Bob now has a classical mixture of either up or down. And what is the classical probability? So what would Bob say? What state does he have? It'll say, I have 50% probability that my spins are in up and 50% probability that my spins are in down. And this 50% probability is not the quantum probability. It's a classical probability. All right? So he can't represent those probabilities in psi. He can't write his state as this. Do you all agree? Because the probabilities 50-50% which he's talking about are not the quantum. He exactly knows what state he is in, quantum state he is in. It's just he doesn't know the classical mixture has a statistical distribution of half-half. Is this point very clear? Difference between quantum probabilities and classical probabilities. So we need a different representation for Bob's state. One example which one,
sorry.
Yeah.
So you say he knows that he has a 50-50 of up and down because Alice measured hers, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So Alice made a measurement on her quantum system. Now Bob's system collapsed and became a classical system. But that classical system has a classical probability of being in up and down. Yes.
Like Bob doesn't know that he has a classical system because Alice can be far away, right?
Exactly. He doesn't know. Yeah. True, that's one problem.
So maybe it should be like equivalent, like the classical probability and the
quantum. In quantum mechanics, yes. If he does measurement, he'll see up and down, which is equal if he had superposition of, right? That's one problem with quantum mechanics. Great. But density matrix formulation doesn't have that problem. It can distinguish between classical mixtures and superposes. We'll come to that point. But that's a very, very good thought. Yeah. Okay.
That if they lead to the same probabilities?
See, what he suggested was, let's say I have a box, again, with spins. I don't know if it's in superposition of up and down, or it's a 50% up and 50% down. Okay, I don't know. How do I find out? I'll do measurement on my system, right? Now, if I do measurement on my 100 spins, this case would give me 50 up, 50 down. This case also would give me 50 up, 50 down. I have no way to distinguish between these two states using quantum mechanical description, like measurement. But density matrix can give you an idea if you have this kind of system or this kind of system. We'll talk about that. Okay? Yeah.
Sorry. Why is there a minus in the...
Because we started with a singlet. singlet has a minus. The total spin is zero, and it has a minus. That's one of the entangled state. There are others, like with plus and so on. But we are specifically talking about singlets here. Okay, yes.
So like, even though Bob doesn't know if he has like a second mixture, quantum mixture, we as a physicist describing the whole system, we know it. So that's
what. Yes, yes. Mathematically. Experimentally, the classical, the quantum mechanical and density metrics, they are going to run into the same problems or so on. As a theoretician, we are trying to see if we can make, we can distinguish between both the cases. All right. So one representation which I can think for Bob's state could be, OK, let's use an ensemble representation. And what does ensemble representation say? That for ensemble representation, we'll use curly brackets and say half probability that's in upspin, half probability that's in downspin. OK, let's use this. Let's still stick to quantum mechanics and attach the classical probabilities in curly brackets. That could be one representation for our system. But now I say, let's say Alice didn't decide to take the measurement or write her singlet in terms of z basis. She decided that she wants to do measurement in x basis. In that case, Alice's outcome would be right? Bob's outcome has changed now. OK, so what? In that case, Bob's representation could be half probability in plus x, half probability in minus x, OK? Which I'm not happy about, because there are two different representations for the same state. Let's more complicate it. Let's say Alice decides to flip a coin, and if she has a head, she decides to do measurement in x basis. And if she has a tail, she decides to do measurement in z basis. In that case, what would be the ensemble representation for Bob's state? What four possibilities would Bob have, and with what probability? So flips a coin, he gets a head, he does measurement in, she does measurement in x basis.
So
1/4 probabilities for each of the outcomes. Right? Same system, but different representation each time, which is inconvenient. And of course, now even more complicated, let's say Alice decides to first roll a dice, then do a coin flip, and then decide. So this would be really, really wrong, long representation for my Bob's state, which is inconvenient. This is one problem with quantum mechanics, that such states, such mixed states, they are basis dependent. Ideally, our mixed state should not be basis dependent. And this is a maximally mixed state. We'll talk about what is maximally mixed state. Okay, that's one problem. Second, now let's say I have a spin again, which is in such kind of state, and it has some probabilities attached to it. And I ask you, find the state of the system. Obviously, you say, oh, no, I can't find the state of the system with single spin. Give me at least a thousands or more of them prepared exactly the same way. Then I'll do measurement on all of them, find a statistical data, find these probabilities, and attach. And then I'll say, oh, this ensemble of spins which I gave you was in this state, right? You can't tell me the state of the spin if I give you just single spin. Is that right? But still, yeah.
What if we do experiment on the same spin like multiple times, like comparing it again?
Once the system has collapsed.
And then you compare it again and do the experiment again on the same spin.
With
it's like doing.
Yes, but it has to be a spin which is similarly prepared, which is difficult to do. So you'll get some experimental uncertainties, but yeah, you'll get these probabilities close to 1 by root 2.
So when we do an ensemble of, we have an ensemble and we do measurements on each of them and we get a certain statistical probability at the end, we are making the assumption that each of the particles in that ensemble have this representation.
Yes.
So is that an assumption or is that?
Theoretical assumption, yes. Experimentally, it's extremely difficult to do. This is exactly the point which I'm coming about. Because each of these spins, even though they are exactly prepared similarly, they'll still have some phase difference. Each still spin will have a phase difference with the other spin. But when you're taking out the statistical data, the information you're getting about is this 1 by root 2, 1 by root 2. There's no way you can get the information about these phases. Does that make sense? So I don't know anything about phi. And let's say the experiment which we are talking about, it's producing spins, and the spin source is not a very good one. It's a terrible spin source, and each spin it's spitting out has a different phase. Such system would be called a decohort system. Okay, so there are like 100 spins, and each spin has phi 1, phi 2, and so on, phi. Each spin has a different phase vector attached to it. Such a state is a decohort system. It doesn't have a good coherence, okay? Not good coherence. And in quantum mechanical description, I cannot find if my ensemble of spin is a good coherent ensemble or a decoherent ensemble. All right? Is this okay? You have to just nod, say yes or no. Can we go to the next problem with quantum mechanical description? Okay, great. So first is this basis dependence. Second is it doesn't give me a good information about coherence or decoherence. The only way I can find if the state is if the ensemble is has a good coherence or not, is by finding an interference pattern, right? If I get an interference pattern, that means they are in coherent state. If I don't get an interference pattern, that means it is not in a coherent state. Okay. Ah, and the third problem, which we talk about, that there's no way that I can distinguish between pure states and mixtures. And what I mean by pure state and mixtures is, pure states are perfectly prepared states, which in like upspin or in downspin. So I have 100 spins, and all spins are in up, or all spins are in down, or all spins are in perfect superposition of up and down. So these are all pure states. The ensemble consists of spins of same kind, okay? Mixtures would mean maximally mixed state. Would mean I have 50% probability that they are in up, 50% probability they are in down. And then we have a degree of mixing as well, okay? So this is a maximally mixed state, which Bob had. So there's no way I can distinguish between these two states. Okay. So instead of the quantum mechanical description, which works so well for single states, single spins if we talk about, but when we talk about ensembles or mixtures, it doesn't work so well, right? So what we are going to use instead is density metrics. formulation. And it's also called density operator. And since it's an operator, it has a form like this, okay? So this is my density matrix for pure states. So if all my states were in up, down, or perfect superposition of up and down, this would be my density operator or density matrix for that system, okay? For pure. All of same kind. But let's say if I have mixtures which have classical uncertainties attached to them, in that case, let's say I have a subsystem of n subsystems, n spin states, each representing by psi I, okay? In our previous example, we had two subsystems, one with up and one with down, okay? So I have n, and each has its own psi representation, and this representation has classical probability wi attached to it. So in that case, my density matrix or density operator would be okay. And since this might be the first time a lot of people are seeing, let's do an example for pure. Can you calculate the density matrix for a pure system which are in superposition perfect? So all spins in this, 100 spins, all in this state. Can you calculate the density matrix for such a system? And then when you're done, calculate the density matrix for a mixed system. Mixed would be 50%, so half in up and, am I switching between 0, 1 and plus and minus? Am I doing that? Yeesh. I decided I should be using the same, yeah. Which one is more comfortable, plus, minus or 0, 1?
0, 1.
Sure. 0, 1? Okay. So, and can I use for x's and y's, can I use this? All right, okay, I'm really sorry. And I give you 2 minutes. It shouldn't be a very big problem. Can you quickly do it and then share what should be the density matrix for both? And in matrix form, this should be a matrix representation. All right, it might seem too trivial for a few who have already worked a lot with density matrices. Okay, is this thing fine? And now you know how to distinguish between pure and mixtures, mathematically, not experimentally. This is a pure, this is a density matrix for a pure, and it has off-diagonal terms. This is a maximally mixed state. There are no off-diagonal terms for this. Okay. So observables. How do we find out observable with density matrix formulation? Okay, so let's see. Let's say we have a more general case where we have a lot of spins with state psi I, and each has a probability or the weight factor as wi. Okay, that case, if I'm trying to find my observable for the ith system, I would say right, and my psi I can be represented in a basis n. And if I'm trying to find the expectation value for my entire ensemble, so this is the expectation value or the observable value which I'll get using just ith system. Since there are n ith, like different systems, it would be and just by a little bit of math here, just moving around things, I can write this as, my notes has all those small steps, but my expectation value for the entire ensemble now would be and if I use completeness for my basis, because it's a good basis, I can write it as which is nothing but my trace of this matrix A. So this is trace, summing over all the diagonal elements of this matrix. All right? So this is how I represent observables or expectation value of operators using density matrix. So I write the corresponding matrix for my operator, multiply the density matrix, and then take out the trace. That's all. So easy. Okay?
Yeah. You assume the states are normalized.
Which states? Yes, assuming that they are normalized, yeah. And if they are not normalized, you just divide it by trace of rho. Yeah, that's a good point. So I'm assuming they're normalized, yes.
Well, for the pure state, what does the subscript I mean?
Okay, so subscript I would mean, in our previous example, when we said there were mixtures of 50% up and 50% down. So this is psi 1 and this is psi 2. So psi I, in this case, I is 1 and 2 only. So the complete system consists of two subsystems. So I can change from 1 to 2. One subsystem is represented by all ups, and the second subsystem is represented by all down. I could have n subsystems where there was some probability of finding them in superposition of up and down, just up or down with a different combination of up and down superposition, so on. So these represent, these I is referring to the subsystems in my ensemble. Okay, is the picture not clear yet?
I'm a bit confused because it's 0 and 1, it sounds like it's a basis for the subsystem. So I just wonder why we distinguish between.
In this particular case, yes, not, but there could be a system where, so I could have a ensemble where psi I could be So it's not necessary that it should be in that basis, but it should be, I should be able to express that in terms of basis. Okay, so that's why I'm using.
It just represents two orthogonal states in the subsystem.
These two are not necessarily orthogonal, but the bases are orthogonal. Oh, still not clear. So let me draw a box. A box again, 100 spins, or maybe say, let's say 10 spin. Half of them are in this superposition. Half of them are in this superposition. So it's an ensemble of two subsystems, one represented like this, while the other represented like this, and they are not necessarily orthogonal to each other. But they are being represented in the same basis. So if I'm doing measurement on this part of the spin in Z, I should be doing measurement on this part of the system in Z basis as well.
Okay.
So these should be represented by the same basis. Okay? Okay. All right. This is fine. Can we go and discuss properties real quickly? Because I want to do two interesting examples. Any questions so far? So a few properties. First is that they are Hermitian. All density matrices, they are Hermitian, which means which is like pretty obvious here. A really very important property for these density matrices is that they have real eigenvalues and positive ones, which means that whenever I take trace, and if my system is normalized, the trace of these density matrices should be equal to 1. Okay. I can quickly show this. So trace would mean summing over all diagonal elements. So this is my matrix, and I'm summing over all diagonal elements. Now, if I substitute in here the definition for row, move things a bit around. These are just numbers. I can bring them on the other side. Use completeness for n. What I'll get is, and if my states are normalized, in this case, it should be 1. And it should give me sum of all classical probabilities, which is equal to 1. OK? Trace of row square. Now, this is a third property. Trace of row square is always less than or equal to trace of which is much really easy to show that let's say again it's taking again, moving things around. These are just numbers. I can bring it here. Use completeness for n. What I'll get is this. And this sum is always less than equal to and this is nothing but your trace rho square. All right, I think this is something like Schwarz inequality or something. All right, and a very interesting case when trace of rho is exactly equal to trace of rho square is exactly equal to trace of rho. And since trace of rho is 1, can I get rid of the square sign? Such states are called pure states, which we talked about. So all spins, and they are all the same. Okay, this is a test of checking if your ensemble is pure or it has some mix properties. Yeah.
That's equivalent to saying that all psi and psi j are orthogonal, right?
All psi and?
Psi and psi j are orthogonal.
No, we didn't use that. So this is psi I. They are normalized, but they are not necessarily orthogonal. They could be something else as well. I didn't.
I mean, like, the what you just wrote, that those are pure states. Trace, so that would mean the trace, those two things are equal, right? So
this two are equivalent, yes, and this here is always less than if I
but I'm talking about the case where they're equal, those two. In that case, all psi I and psi j are orthogonal, right? Because then all of the inner products are zero, and you're only left with inner products psi psi. Or am I thinking about it wrong?
No, I don't think so. There's definitely some. We can do one. You can do one example, quick example, and then see. It should not be. Let's check for this, for example. I don't think that's true. So if I have all psi i's, so I have just this state, pure state. I don't think it's normalized, like orthogonal as well. The bases are, but the states are not.
Okay, we can.
Yeah, we can do one quick example, and then it's like it's not a big, like too much of calculation. But this is the important point: for all states which are not pure, trace of rho square is always less than 1, or you can say is always less than trace of rho. But for pure states, for pure ensembles, this is always equal to 1. That's a test. And can you check the previous example? Can you check if that's true for your pure state and mixed state? So our pure state should have trace rho square as 1. Can you quickly check, maybe in your head? Just take square of that matrix and then find trace. It would be 1. OK? Yep. What's interesting about density matrix is that even though I'm getting a lot of useful information out of it, but it still doesn't give me the information about the subsystems it's composed of. It doesn't give me the information about psi i's. For example, let's say I have an ensemble. Where I have upspins occurring with probability 2/3 and downspins occurring with probability 1/3. So this is first ensemble. And second ensemble is I have, so this is psi 1 and this is psi 2. Psi 1 is with probability 1/2. So these are classical probabilities. Probability 1/2 and psi 2 again with probability half. Now, if I, so to, the, to me, just by looking, this ensemble looks much different from this ensemble, right? They're composed of different subsystems. This is composed of only ups and downs, and this is composed of some superpositions of ups and downs. This is purely a classical mixture. But when I find density matrix for this, and you can quickly do that, the density matrix for both these is 2 by 3, 1 by 3. So just by looking at the density matrix, it's telling me that it's a mixture. This is also a mixture, right? But just looking at, because it's a mixture because off-diagonal terms are 0. But just by looking at the density matrix, I cannot say the systems it's composed of. I cannot tell anything about them. Different configurations could give me the same density matrix. All right? This is something which density matrices doesn't address. But let's talk about good things regarding density matrices. Let's write the time evolution for density matrix. Or do you want to do one example, an interesting one, which is going to address our problem for that Alice and Bob problem? Let's do that instead of boring math. I'm sorry, some might not like this, but let's come back to the example, this problem, where Alice, where Bob's mixed state was depending on what basis Alice was choosing to do her measurement, right? Let's do that example again. So let's write density matrix for, in order to address this, I'm going to write a density matrix for pure spin half. So what Bob has a box where he has either ups or downs, right? That's all he has. So let's see how I can represent all ups in density matrix for Bob and all downs for density matrix in Bob, and see if the combined density matrix for Bob is independent of the basis Alice chooses or not, all right? So on a block sphere, we saw that I can represent a state, any spin, as cos phi. Right? So if I write density matrix for this state, I could write it as, you can quickly do the math in your head. And I can represent this density matrix. I can break the diagonal terms separate, off diagonal terms separate. I can write it as a sum of two matrices. And it could be like half. So these two diagonal matrices would give me the diagonal elements, and you can write the off diagonals. All right, and I can write this as identity. I can write this as cos theta, this as minus cos theta, using those trigonometric relations. And I can write this as the whatever S matrix is a 1, 0, 0, 1, which is a polyspin Z. And I could write this as, so this is sine theta by 2. And this is nothing but if you look at this, this is nothing but your dot product of the block vector. I'll tell you what block vector is and the polyspin matrix. And block vector is your so block vector is another representation for your spin. So you have a block sphere and you have a spin which I'm representing as a ket vector, but this spin is also a vector, right? And I can write this vector in my Cartesian coordinate system like this. It's a simple vector, okay? So now if you look at this, if I can now represent the 50% of Bob's upspin in so let's say Alice did measurement in Z basis. So Alice has 50% of spins in up, right? So his spin, like the density matrix for this representation would be and this is not a zero vector, it's the block vector corresponding to my upspin, okay? And 50%, so half of are in this, half of Bob's are in this state. And what is zero and one, if you see? Zero is up and down. I can write this one as minus of zero. Okay, on block sphere, if this is my zero vector, this is my one vector, which is nothing but by negative of the zero vector, right? So in a way, if I find the density matrix for Bob, I would say half contribution from this, half were in up, half in down. What I'll get is an identity matrix. And this is basis independent. Why? Because let's say Alice chose to do her measurements in X basis. In that case, it's independent. Whenever I'm going to find out the density matrix for Bob's mixture, I'll always get I by 2. I'll always end up getting a mixture of half ups and half downs, always. Okay? Do you need a second to grasp this? Because we are already over time and I don't want to move ahead. This is a beautiful concept, and you can check.